Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, MPs ask for an update on the complete reset of streaming. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week, a week when the IFPI published its latest Engaging Music report, telling us that music consumption is now at an all-time high. The survey of 44,000 internet users in 22 countries across the world found that the average music fan is now listening to 20.1 hours of music every single week, which is up from 18.4 hours in last year's survey.
Yeah, so that means, according to the IFPI, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, that people are listening to more music today. I mean, not today as in the day you're listening to this podcast. They've not particularly honed in on that day. They mean today in the sort of around about now sense. More music,
I think everyone understood that.
Today than at any point in human history, supposedly. That was the key stat in this new report. Not only that, not only are they listening to more music than at any point in human history, or at least since the IFPI have been doing this consumption study every year, which is not all of human history, but some of it. Not only are we listening to more music, but we are listening to music from more places than ever before. So yeah, by the IFPI's number crunching, the average person is engaging with music via more than six different methods. So for example, that might include a streaming service and a sort of YouTube type platform and TikTok and radio and TV, maybe even some live music. Hey, maybe you've even got some CDs or vinyl or MP3s and you're listening to music that you bought one day in the past. Those are all different ways that you could be listening to music. And according to the IFPI, average person is accessing music from about six different ways.
Yes, and of those six different ways, the two biggest are audio streaming services and social media platforms, in which we're including things like YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. But which one is the biggest?
Which one is the biggest? He says, pretending he doesn't know and it's not written in this script in front of him. I don't know, Andy. Which one is the biggest?
Well, I'll tell you, because I know you're dying to find out. Although, given that you wrote the story in the Daily, you should know, really.
Sitting here in anticipation, desperately wanting to know, what accounts for more music consumption worldwide? Is it audio streaming services? Is it social media and video platforms? Which could it be?
Well, I'll put you out of your misery. The answer is, it's neither.
Or both.
Okay, well, yeah, you could look at it like that. I choose not to. It's neither. They both account for 32% of listening.
We should note that in the IFPI's report, they don't actually group all the different sorts of audio streaming services together, nor do they group all of the sort of different social media and video platforms together. I mean, I think most people would say it's fine to group the paid for streaming and the free streaming services as one, even though the IFPI report does not. You might be offended by the idea that we group YouTube, TikTok and Instagram, but although the IFPI report does break them down into sort of video platforms, short-form video platforms, and social media platforms, illustrating each of those by saying, oh, well, video platforms would include YouTube, short-form video platforms would include TikTok, and social media would include Instagram. But given that, in my opinion, YouTube could be all of those things, Instagram could be two of those things, I think that the breakdown's a little bit arbitrary anyway. But yeah, if you group all the audio streaming together and then you group all the sort of social media video platforms together, they are both accounting for 32% each of music consumption, which is interesting because it means that while audio streaming obviously is incredibly important today, we all know that, a lot of people are accessing at least some music through the video platforms and the social media platforms as well.
Now, if you're interested in the breakdown of the different types of listening and what they account for, and indeed quite a lot of other stats relating to the listening of music around the world, then we're not going to talk about it here because it's going to take too long. And we've done a lot of stats lately, haven't we? So let's lay off the stats a bit.
Bit of a stat overload on the old Setlist podcast, I feel. So, yeah. I don't think we want to spend another 30 minutes trying to explain pie charts in audio form. Go look at the pie charts.
And this story really is a stat overload. It's a huge number of stats. If you're interested in the stats, then I will put a link in the show notes for this episode and you can go and just wallow in them for a while.
But as you say, and we cannot stress this enough, this RFPI stats pack, as interesting as it may be, is not what we're here to talk about this week on Setlist.
No, this week we're going to focus on just one story, because there's quite a lot to say about it. And that is that last week, MPs on the UK Parliament's Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee heard from music industry experts and representatives about the work that has been ongoing within the music community since that committee published its report last year on the economics of music streaming. There were developments about transparency and data to be updated on, although it was clear from last week's session that artist remuneration remains a key sticking point. Now, as a bit of a change from our usual format this week, and to get some extra insight into what went on at this hearing, we have managed to book one of the people who spoke to the Select Committee to give their insight. So from them, we can get a view on what went on and what the key issues discussed were. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our special guest on this week's edition of Setlist, Managing Director of CMU, Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
So you went to Parliament and you spoke to a Select Committee.
I did. Technically,
that's fun.
Technically, Portcullis House, which is the big building next to Parliament. It wasn't actually in the
close
houses
enough
of Parliament. But yes, so I was asked to go and give my thoughts and updates on all of this to the Culture Select Committee, which I've never done before. So that was interesting.
What did you learn? What was the key thing you took away from the experience of going and speaking to MPs?
That when you get to Portcullis House, the obvious door to use
right
is not the door you're meant to use.
Right.
And neither is the next most obvious door or the next most obvious door. So, yes,
right.
I try to open three different doors, which turns out you have to have a special pass for, before I finally found the door that took me to the public bit of the building where they let the riffraff in to go and answer some questions from some MPs. So next time I'm at Portcullis House, I won't look like an idiot pushing doors and having people waving at me. And then I noticed the sign that said committee rooms or whatever it was. So I think that was probably my main learning, which I'm sure our listeners appreciate having that exclusive insight. And I think that is not an overstatement of what you've just got on this edition of Setlist.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, this is why we got you to speak about this, to get that really deep insight into the inner workings of the British political system.
Also, if you are going to go and answer questions at a Select Committee, and when you get to Portcullis House, you see a nice little cafe and you think, oh, that's good, I could go and get a coffee before this starts, that nice little cafe is beyond those three doors that you're not allowed through. And there's no way to get a coffee in the public area. So, yeah, another useful bit of information there. Maybe I should write a book about this. I don't know. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how select committees work, apparently. Well, it's how Portcullis House works.
Yeah. Shall we? I'm going to ask you some more questions.
Good. Good.
And hopefully there will be less door and coffee based. But we'll see.
On my way out, the exit door wouldn't open. We were stranded in Portcullis House and there was a very confused security guard. He didn't quite know what to do. And in fact, I'm still there. I never got out of the place. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah, we're not here to talk about the doors of Portcullis
House. If you're still
there,
could you get Will Page on instead? I bet he's got some insight.
Hey, Andy Moore, ask me some questions.
Okay. You're now banned from talking about doors
okay.
for the next 10 to 15 minutes. Okay?
Good.
Aside from all that riveting information you just gave us, Remind us what a select committee actually does.
Yes. Now, we've definitely talked about this before on Setlist, because when the Culture Select Committee was doing its inquiry into the economics of music streaming, it was clear that quite a lot of people didn't know what select committees are. So in the UK Parliament, we have select committees. They are made up of backbench MPs. So those are members of Parliament, specifically members of the House of Commons, so elected members of Parliament, who are not also in government. So here in the UK, our government, the ministers of government, are pulled out of Parliament, both the House of Commons and the House of Lords. So some members of Parliament are also ministers. They're also actively involved in running the country. But then those MPs that are not are the backbench MPs. And it is from the backbench MPs that members are recruited for each of these select committees. And the select committees are basically structured in tandem with the different departments of government. So in theory, each department of government has a select committee that is there to monitor what it's doing, scrutinise what it's doing, and also to make recommendations about what that department of government might want to look into or change. So one department of government is the Department of Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. Therefore, there is a select committee that is focused on that area. And although I guess in some ways the most important aspect of what select committees do is actually calling the ministers in and officials of government in to ask them questions about government policy and government initiatives, the select committees can also pick a topic that is relevant to their specialism and then do an inquiry, do a report and make recommendations for how things might change, particularly where those changes might require either government intervention or even a change in the law. So that's what select committees are there for. They don't really have that much power. They can't tell government what to do, but they can definitely scrutinise. That's their primary objective. And they can make recommendations, and sometimes governments take those recommendations and run with them.
So what did this streaming inquiry involve?
Yes, yeah, so regular listeners of Setlist will already know the answer to that question. But in 2020, the Digital Culture Media Sports Select Committee, what from this point onwards I will refer to as the Culture Select Committee,
really isn't necessary.
It's the culture bit that's relevant here. So in 2020, the Culture Select Committee announced that it was going to instigate an inquiry into the economics of music streaming and look at the various issues that have been raised with the way the music streaming business runs. Most of those issues have been raised multiple times in the preceding years, not least by the Music Managers Forum here in the UK, who obviously have been working with us here at CMU for a long time now on the Dissecting the Digital Dollar project, which is all about explaining to managers and the artists and writers they manage how streaming works and what the potential issues are and what debates the music community should be having. So these issues were not new, but of course, in the context of 2020, the streaming sector came super into focus as the music industry lost lots of its other revenue streams, particularly the live revenue streams, to the COVID pandemic. And so what we saw in 2020, of course, is because lots of artists and songwriters who rely on live staff or merchandise or sync or education to make most of their money, because a lot of those revenue streams were either hit or in some cases completely stopped as a result of COVID, everyone started to look at the streaming revenue stream, which was the one music industry revenue stream which was not affected at all by the pandemic. Actually, if anything, the pandemic helped further growth of that side of the business. And for various reasons, streaming is quite often the one music revenue stream where artists and songwriters actually see a minority share. And that basically was the motivating factor for this select committee inquiry to say, well, hang on a second, that's the one revenue stream not hit by COVID. It's an important growth revenue stream for the music industry. Yet for some reason, in some cases, not all cases, we should stress, but in some cases, artists and writers see a really small cut of that revenue stream. That doesn't seem right. Why is that? And so in order to answer that question, the select committee had this inquiry. They called lots of people from across the industry and the streaming services to come and answer questions. Lots and lots of people in the music community made written submissions, including us here at CMU. And then on the back of all of that, they published a report that came out in 2021. It was a long report. It made many recommendations for how the streaming business and indeed copyright law itself could be reformed. It called for a complete reset of the way streaming works. So that came out in the middle of 2021, and I guess the aim of last week's Select Committee hearing, you know, more than a year on, was to say, okay, we made all these recommendations, we call for a complete reset, what has happened since?
Well, indeed, yeah. So it's over a year since that report was published. What has been happening since then?
So, quite a lot has been happening behind the scenes, and I have been involved in some of that, which is why, if you were wondering, I was asked to go and speak last week. I guess also because of all the digital dollar work that we've done with the MMF, we have been focused on all of this for quite a long time here at CMU. So, following the Select Committee's report, the government responded, because remember what I said, a Select Committee can't actually tell government what to do, but it can make recommendations, and it made a lot of recommendations, including, as I say, some copyright law reforms. What the government said was, basically, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but basically what they said was, okay, you've raised some important issues, we accept that. Maybe those copyright law reforms you proposed, or at least some of them, are something that we should be seriously considering. However, government said, our preference would be for the music industry, the wider music community, to come together and to come up with voluntary, industry-led solutions to each of the issues that have been raised that don't require formal government intervention, don't require a change to copyright law. So let's give the industry an opportunity to do that. And then, if they don't, and the issues are not addressed, maybe then we'll consider the copyright law reforms set out in the report. On the back of that, the UK's Intellectual Property Office, which is a part of government, convened a thing called the Music Industry Contact Group, which basically is a committee made up mainly of the different trade bodies within the music industry, representing artists and songwriters and musicians and managers and labels and publishers and the streaming services themselves. Although there are some independent experts on that committee, I'm one of those independent experts on the contact group. And then underneath that contact group, the IPO instigated three strands of work, each focused on a different issue that had been raised in the Select Committee's inquiry. And then basically, since this time last year, those three strands of work have been ongoing.
Okay, so what are those three strands of work?
Well, that's a good question. So, basically, the three strands of work are focused respectively on transparency, data, and remuneration. And the fact that the IPO split the work up like this was a sensible thing to do, because anybody who's read the Dissecting Digital Dollar book or tuned in to the various setlist podcasts that we've done over the years on this issue will know that when we talk about the economics of music streaming debate, we're actually talking about a number of different distinct debates. And sometimes when people talk about streaming, those different debates all get confused. Everyone's talking about something slightly different and nothing is achieved. So it is important to say, okay, there are distinct debates, distinct issues. Let's separate them out. And therefore, it was sensible to say, okay, we'll have one strand of work focused on transparency, another bit of work focused on data, and then another bit of work focused on artist remuneration. That was a sensible thing to do. And then basically since then, with both transparency and data, specific working groups were convened to consider and discuss the issues and possible solutions when it comes to transparency and data. Meanwhile, research was commissioned around artist remuneration and in particular the various copyright law reforms that were proposed in the Select Committee's report. So that's the sort of the three strands of work that have been ongoing over the last year. It has to be said it is still a work in progress. None of those strands have got official, formal, final outcomes as yet. But behind the scenes, quite a lot of work has been ongoing.
Okay, well, let's concentrate on the one that you're involved in first. What is the Transparency Working Group doing?
Yes. So as you say, as well as sitting on the Music Industry Contact Group, I'm also a member of that working group. So at last week's Select Committee, it was mainly the Transparency Working Group that I spoke about because it's the one I'm in the best position to talk about. And I guess, well, first thing to say is, what do we even mean by transparency? And throughout the digital dollar work, and I mean through the work I've done with the Music Managers Forum over the last 7 years now, since the first digital dollar report was published, I must have spoken over those 7 years to literally hundreds of managers and lawyers and accountants who work with artists. I reckon in excess of 500 now, all over the world. And pretty much every single person I've spoken to, when you say, well, okay, well, what do you see as the issues with the way streaming works? Pretty much every single one has raised transparency, which is to say the lack of clarity and information about how the deals that have been done between the music industry and the streaming services and how the royalties are processed each month, a lack of clarity and information about how all of that works from an artist and songwriter perspective. That said, although everybody raises transparency as an issue, different people probably have slightly different transparency concerns. So the main thing I've done through that working group over the last year is I sat down with artists and writers and managers and lawyers and accountants working with the MMF, but also the Featured Artists Coalition and the Musicians Union and the Ivors Academy, which obviously represents songwriters. And we put together a wish list. This is all the data and information that artists and writers and their managers need. Things they need to understand in order for them to be able to properly plan and manage and develop their own individual digital businesses. Because, of course, every artist, every writer is running their own business, and digital is now a key part of that business. And with this data and this information, they would be able to properly understand that aspect of what they do. So we began with a wish list. It was quite a long wish list. Meanwhile, concurrent to that, the labels initially and then subsequently the publishers and PRS got involved in this process as well, started to draft up a code setting out various commitments that labels and distributors and publishers and collective societies and the streaming services, and for that matter, artists and managers who are also operating as labels, because these days lots of managers, lots of artists are also labels. Basically, commitments that all of those people could make to say, okay, we recognise that yes, artists and writers, they do need to know this and this and this, and maybe this is how we could make that information available. So a sort of a framework was drafted earlier in the year. Then the artists, the writers, the managers then said, okay, good framework, but we also want this, 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 and this. And basically, those conversations are now ongoing. The aim being that this sort of this plan of action for how we can get more transparency in digital music industry, that plan of action hopefully will be ready in early 2023 so that labels and publishers and distributors and the streaming services and the collecting societies can say, okay, we're going to start providing you this extra information. This is how we're going to do it. And as artists, writers, managers, this is how you can get that data, get that information to properly understand what you're doing. It's still a work in progress, but that is what's been going on over the last year. And as I say, and we said this last week in the Select Committee hearing, we are hoping early 2023 that plan of action will be pretty much ready to share with the wider world.
Okay, so things are moving along with that. What about the data working group? What is that doing?
So the data working group, I'm not a member of that working group, although through my ongoing work with the Music Managers Forum and then the MMF works very closely with the FAC and the Ivors Academy and the Musicians Union on all of this. So I have been helping the MMF express its priorities with data. What are we talking about with the metadata working group? We're basically talking about rights data, the data that allows us to identify recordings and songs and the artists who appear on recordings, the writers who wrote the songs. And actually, from my perspective, the most important metadata thing is the data that links the recording to the song, which in technical terms, the ISRC is a code that identifies a recording. Inside that recording is a song. We need to identify the song that is the ISWC. Now, for lots of reasons that we will not go into today, otherwise this will end up being the longest podcast in human history, there are issues with the way data is organized, and it has the biggest impact on songwriters and song royalties. If you're interested in this, the MMF and CMU earlier this year at The Great Escape published a thing called the Song Royalties Manifesto that sets out the issues and then various proposed solutions from the MMF as to how those issues could be addressed, and that'll explain it all to you. And what the metadata working group has been trying to do is to say, okay, we know there are some issues around data provision, and again, what commitments could labels and publishers and indeed artists, writers and managers, because this is really an area where artists, writers and managers have as much to do as everybody else, what commitments could everybody make to try and get better, more extensive, more accurate data into the system so that slowly but surely Initially, probably the benefit would be that songwriters would get credited more often when their music is streamed, which is important, but in my opinion, not as important as getting songwriters paid. There is quite a lot of work that needs to be done in order to get songwriters paid faster and more accurately. But baby steps, there are some relatively simple things. I say simple, it will require quite a lot of effort on the part of everybody in the music industry, but relatively simple things that can be done to move us in that direction. And so, yeah, the aim of the metadata working group, again, work in progress, is to set up a plan of action where everyone says, okay, we're going to take responsibility for this, we're going to make sure this happens, and we get better data in the system. And I mean, over the years, so many challenges that the music rights industry faces in the digital domain and elsewhere, it always comes back to shitty data. And if we could just fix this data problem, and there's always a tendency to say, oh, it's really complicated, we'll never fix that. It's not actually that complicated, but it does require a lot of people in the industry slightly changing the way they work, taking on one or two extra responsibilities. But if we could just fix all of that data nonsense, it would benefit the entire music industry in so many ways, and everyone would make more money, and especially the songwriters. So that's the ambition of that. And as I say, another work in progress, but the hope is that alongside the transparency plan of action in early 2023, there will be a data plan of action as well.
Okay, so things are moving along with that as well. That brings us on to the third thing, fair remuneration. What's happening with that? Is everyone getting paid fairly now? they've finished that, they've sorted that one, that one's done.
All fine, everything's, you know, nobody in the music industry thinks they should be getting more money anymore. It's all sorted, it's all fine, everybody's happy. No, of course not. And if you did tune in to the Select Committee hearing last week, and it is available on demand on Parliament's website if you're really interested, I'm sure Andy Malt will put a link in the show notes. But
I might even embed it.
Even embed it?
Yes. You couldn't do that the other day when I tried to embed it in the story, but you know, you never know.
You never know. So if you had tuned in, or you do tune in, you will probably notice that I've been quite positive and optimistic in this little conversation that we're having here. There was less optimism and less positivity in the room. And it has to be said, the reason for that is, of the three strands of work that the IPO commissioned, the one that is least developed, that has progressed the least, is around fair remuneration, how artists and also songwriters get paid and how the money is split up. Now, the main reason why the remuneration strand of the work is further behind is because, as I mentioned earlier, the IPO commissioned these research reports, and those are just about to be completed now. And so it was decided that we should wait for that research to come in before any conversations take place around remuneration. But it does mean that that is the strand that has had the least progression. And while transparency in data is important, everybody agrees it's important. I mean, I think personally, I think it's incredibly important. Maybe other people see it as being important, but, you know, kind of on the side. But what is certainly true is, however important you think data and transparency are, for a lot of people in the artist, management and songwriter community, the single most important issue is creator, artist, songwriter remuneration, and therefore everyone is a bit down that that is the bit where there has been the least progression.
So when it comes to remuneration, what are the questions that need to be answered?
Well, I would argue that when it comes to remuneration, we actually have another three strands to consider, because when it comes to how artists and songwriters get paid when their music is streamed, there are different issues at each stage of the process through which the money flows. So let me very quickly explain what I mean through the questions that I think need to be answered. So question number one is, every month, the money that comes in, say through Spotify selling subscriptions, is split amongst all of the tracks that appear on the Spotify platform. So money is allocated to every single track that has been streamed. There's a system for doing that. Is that system fair? Then the money is shared out between the recording rights that go to labels and artists, the song rights that are shared between songwriters and music publishers, and the streaming service that gets to keep a chunk of the money for itself. is the way the money is split, so that 50 to 55% goes to the recording, 10 to 15% to the song, 30 to 35% to the service. Is that fair? Then, of the money that flows through the recorded side that gets split between the label and the artist, is the split between the label and the artist fair? So three different questions that need to be answered. And the focus really of the remuneration strand of the IPO work is the latter of those, how the money gets split between the label and the artist, because the copyright law reforms that were proposed in the Select Committee's report were really all focused on artist remuneration. How much of streaming money an artist receives, so of the money that is allocated to an artist's recording each month, and when the 50 to 55% of that is then paid through to the label or possibly a music distributor, how much of that is actually then paid to the artist depends entirely on the deal the artist has done with their label or if they are self-releasing with their distributor. So it could be anything from a few percent to 100% of that money. Now, the copyright law reforms that were proposed in the Select Committee's report, two of them were about changing old deals that have been negotiated between artists and labels. So that probably wouldn't apply to people who'd done their deals relatively recently. But if an artist did their deal in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, or even the 2000s, and they felt that the deal was no longer fair because of streaming, which wasn't really something that was anticipated when they did the deal, either they could force the label to renegotiate that deal, or they could even terminate that deal, depending on which of the copyright law reforms went ahead. Or, of course, the other thing that was proposed was, should the artist get some, or maybe even all, of their cut of the streaming money through the collective licensing system with a principle called performer equitable remuneration, which would mean that artists would be paid at an industry standard rate rather than subject to terms of their record contract. So those were the proposed copyright law reforms in the report. They're all kind of to do with how the artist gets paid and the split between label and artist. So that has been the focus so far. We know that, generally speaking, record labels oppose all three of those and have got various issues with those, both in terms of what it would mean for their own income and their ability to invest in new talent, but also the impact it would have on artists who are working with distributors and their own labels to release their music. But I suppose this is a long-winded way of saying that the focus to date has been around the split of the money between the artist and the label, because that is what the copyright law reforms would address. But so far, that work has been research heavy. There hasn't been a working group to discuss those proposals, or indeed an alternative proposal. And I guess the big message at last week's Select Committee from the artist and songwriter community was, we need remuneration to be sorted out. It's the single biggest issue. We're annoyed that it is the part of this work that is least developed, and we need to get a committee together ASAP to talk about remuneration, because while it's great that there's been some progress on data and transparency, you know, assuming agreements can be reached, that's still to happen. But even if agreements are reached, that's great. But we want a solution around remuneration, I guess, was the sort of the short summary of everything that was said, particularly from the artist and writer side during last week's committee hearing.
Now, you mentioned there a possible alternative approach to remuneration. What would that be?
Well, one thing that has been floated is the idea of having a voluntary agreement in the record industry, so not copyright law reform, where labels basically voluntarily committed to do one or maybe two things. The first is basically to apply a minimum royalty rate across their catalogue, basically doing what labels like Beggars already do. So a label like the Beggars Group says, okay, we have a minimum royalty rate for streaming that goes into all of our new deals. But not only that, it also applies to every deal we've ever done. So maybe you did your deal in the 1980s. Technically, you're due a 12% royalty when your recordings are monetized, but we're going to pay you the standard modern 25% royalty because we're applying that across the catalog. So companies like Beggars are already doing that. And some people, and indeed, you know, some people in the artist and management community are saying, okay, we're not saying that we are taking those copyright law reforms off the table completely, but that's an interesting idea. We would definitely be up for discussing that. Doesn't help session musicians. Session musicians currently get nothing from streaming. And if you did go for an ER model, so that the money went through the collective licensing system, chances are the session musicians would get some of that money. But maybe in addition to a minimum royalty rate, there could be some sort of fund where some money goes into it on a regular basis that is then paid out to the session musicians who appear on the most streamed tracks. Now, there is precedent for this because the French record industry came together and agreed a deal a little bit like that earlier this year. So that would be the other option in terms of remuneration. Within the label community, there is some support for that with some labels. I mean, clearly, beggars are already doing it, so they would be more than willing to sign up to a code like that because that's already how they operate. And there are other indies like that too. Of course, there would then be a debate about what the minimum royalty should be, and that's very much up in the air at the moment. But there are some labels who are not that keen on this idea. And what the majors would probably say is they've already made a change to the way they operate for the benefit of heritage artists, artists on old record deals, because they are now paying royalties through to artists who did their deals before the year 2000, who never actually recouped on those original record deals, which means they never paid back any advance and other recoupable costs that the label covered when the deal was done. And because they'd never recouped on their original record deal, they weren't actually getting any royalties from streaming, but now they are. Should also note that that's something that Beggars has done for years, but the majors are now doing that too. And so the argument from the majors' side is, well, we've already done something about artist remuneration. We feel like that was a very generous gesture, and therefore we don't feel that an additional gesture like a minimum royalty is required. I think with the majors, I suspect there isn't even consensus within the majors on all of this. But certainly within the independent community, there are some labels who are very much supportive for the idea of some sort of minimum royalty and possibly a session musician fund. Quite a lot of the indies are already doing stuff like that anyway. So that would be the fourth option instead of giving artists the legal right to renegotiate old deals or terminate old deals or to get artists paid through the ER system. But none of this really has been discussed as part of the IPO-led work to date because these research reports have been in development. But clearly from the Select Committee hearing last week, the artists, the writers and the managers are going to be demanding that a committee is now convened to discuss all of these things because, as we've said, artists, writers, managers, very clear last week that while data and transparency is important, as I say, in my opinion, really important, but we need some progression on remuneration as well, is what the artists and writers and managers were saying last week.
So we've had this latest Select Committee hearing. Work is ongoing. There's more work to do. What are the next steps now?
Well, I guess all of this needs a few more months, possibly even another 6 months, which does mean that things are taking longer than everyone originally hoped, because a year ago, it was agreed that we would have about a year to do all of this. Well, we're now a year on and we've still got quite a bit of work to do. But I guess in about 6 months' time, hopefully there will be some big announcements, maybe even sooner than that. And then it will be a case for the Select Committee to look at that and say, okay, I mean, I don't think whatever happens, they're going to consider it to be a complete reset. Personally, I'm not sure a complete reset was actually required, but will it be enough to address many of the issues that were raised? So I think we need a few more months. Then I suspect the Select Committee will look at this again at some point in 2023. But let's be optimistic. We have got the industry around the table. There is some progression on transparency. There is some progression on data. Hopefully we'll get some solid plans of action on both of those things in the new year. Maybe there's a deal to be done on remuneration. Although I would throw in one last thing, which is, I do think there's some managing expectations here, because I think there are a lot of people who are early on in their music careers, or maybe they're making more alternative niche music, who don't see a huge amount of money coming in from streaming, and who are thinking, oh, if we can just get these changes, everything will be fine. I'll make loads of money from streaming. And some artists would definitely be better off financially if these changes were to go ahead. Certainly, they would have a better understanding of how their music is making money, and that's really important. And the data stuff, if you went all the way through with the data reforms, would definitely help songwriters, because less money would go missing, less money would be lost to admin costs. But I think a lot of artists would not see a sudden spike in income because, and this was the other point that was raised, I mean, you mentioned Will Page, the Economist, was also taking part last week, and he talked about this. So did Jeff Taylor from the BPI. One of the issues here is there's so much music. There are so many artists putting out music onto the streaming services, all competing for people to play and for their share of the money that comes in every month. Add in the fact that you've got 70 years of catalogue that is also competing for all of that attention. It is an incredibly challenging time to be a musician. It's also a brilliant time to be a musician. The reason it's challenging is because it's so easy to release music. And the fact it's so easy to release music is brilliant, but it is a challenge. And I think sometimes artists, writers, managers feel that when people bring that up, maybe they're using that as a distraction tactic to not deal with the issues. But even if we did deal with all of the issues, that is a simple fact of what it's like in the digital music market today. And that will always be a challenge. And even if every single thing proposed in the Select Committee report last year was to happen, I think a lot of artists would still not be making much money from streaming. And I think, yeah, a reality check there, manage expectations.
Well, Chris Cook of CMU, thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Setlist. I hope we'll be able to get you back on sometime.
Yes, that would be lovely. And for any PRs who are listening, those PRs who keep emailing us asking if we want to interview their clients on Setlist, even though this is not an interview-based podcast. I mean, obviously, those PRs presumably aren't listening. That's why they're asking.
Yeah, I don't think they're listening. I think that's the problem.
But let's be clear, we have not pivoted into an interview-based podcast. We don't want to interview your clients. We just love the sound of our own voice too much.
Yes, we've got us and we're fine. We don't need anybody else. Well, that's not to say we won't one day do something with somebody else again. We used to occasionally.
Yeah, I think I'm right in saying that in the 47 years we've been doing this podcast, we have had guests on three separate occasions.
Yeah.
Four, if you count this week.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time when I always introduced you as my guest this week.
Oh, was that a joke that we used to do?
It is, yeah, yeah. And then I think we had some guests.
So good was that joke. I've blocked it out of my memory.
I don't know how long I did that for. I think I stopped after we actually had some guests. But anyway, if you want to go back into the CMU archive and find those episodes, I'm not sure why you'd want to go and seek just that out, but, you know, maybe. You can. We've got the whole archive up on our website, setlistpodcast.com.
People have said that the edition with Becky Brook talking about music rights, the one edition where you weren't there, is one of their favourites. But also quite out of date by now. So maybe we need to get Becky back in to do an updated version of that, given that how popular that edition was.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. For now, I'm saying no guests. It's us two talking about the music industry. We don't need you. I mean, sometimes you get people saying, oh, do you want to talk to this person who owns a private jet company? That comes up surprisingly frequently. No. Why would I want that person on my podcast?
Unless we can record it on their private jet and it's taking us somewhere useful.
Yeah, okay. Well, all right. Well, that's something to think about. Maybe I will email those people back. Anyway, but that is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed this week, I will put links in. And indeed, not just read, you can go and watch those Select Committee videos, articles and videos right there in the show notes, which you'll find in your podcast player right now or at the previously mentioned setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. If you've not done that already, then you'll get new episodes delivered right to your phone or whatever every single week of the year, possibly not next week because we haven't quite worked out how we're going to fit it in because Chris is going away.
I'm in Milan next week, this week as the podcast goes out. If you're at the Line Check event in Milan, do come and say hello. I'm delivering two speed briefings, moderating two panels. It's going to be brilliant. It is TBC as to whether or not we can find an hour in that schedule for me to sneak off to a corner of the Line Check venue and record a podcast. It may or may not happen. Who knows? More suspense.
Are you going on a private jet?
Not going on a private jet.
Not yet. Maybe I could get the private jet person in next week.
This podcast goes out on Monday morning. I'm flying out Tuesday evening. So there is 24 hours for that PR to make that happen.
Okay. Well, let's see. Where did I get to? Rate and review the show. that's very helpful. It helps to get the algorithms churning and put us in front of other people. And also people see many, many five-star ratings, which is obviously the rating you would give us. Then other people look at it and go, that must be a very good podcast. I should listen to that. I wonder if they ever talk about private jets. If you don't like algorithms, some people don't, you can just tell people. If you're in the pub at some point this week, tell the person behind the bar about it. You know, there's a certain chance that they might be a musician and that might be useful. So that's something to do. Just that's it. Like, don't tell friends. I've often said tell friends. Tell people who work behind bars and no one else about this podcast. If you want to talk to us about anything, maybe send us a photo of your new bar staff friend. Email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the Music Business Podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com. MPs on the UK Parliament Digital Culture Media and Support. MPs on the UK Parliament Digital Culture Media and Support Select Committee last...
You said
did
support.
I? MPs on the UK Parliament Digital... I'm going to laugh now. Just the thought of it happening again. Anyway, right. MPs on the UK Parliament Digital Culture Media and Support... Fuck's
sake. You got it right then.
I know. All right. I'm going to get a list. It's not even funny.
No.
MPs on the UK Parliament's Digital Culture... Fucking hell!
You're doing it fine.
I don't know why you're making me laugh.
I don't know why you stopped.
It's because I started laughing. Oh, God. There's no reason to laugh at this. It's not funny. I'm going to be here all fucking day. MPs on the UK Parliament Digital... Fuck off!
Maybe we should come back to the intro later.
It's all right, I'm going to get it. Sport. It's a funny word, isn't it?
Nope.
Never noticed how funny a word that is before.